I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. What is the right balance of history, art, and 21st century sensitivities? A Baltimore City task force this week made preliminary recommendations to remove two Confederate monuments. We'll speak to a member of the commission and someone from the Maryland Division of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Plus, this week, Maryland was ranked dead last among states in how its consumers manage their credit. Nina Heck from the nonprofit GuideWell Financial Solutions shares tips on tackling debt. We'll also talk about news headlines from the Baltimore Business Journal, how colleges in Maryland are approaching consent and sexual assault on campus, and how local musicians are remembering David Bowie. History, credit scores, and much more on the Friday News Roundup on Midday after these headlines. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. It's great that you're with us to wrap up some of this week's news. On today's News Roundup, we'll hear about why Marylanders are arguably the worst of all 50 states in money management. Nina Heck from GuideWell Financial Solutions will join us for some tips about how to better balance your budget. And also Sarah Gantz from the Baltimore Business Journal catches us up on their headlines for this week. And the Creative Alliance is holding a David Bowie tribute on Sunday. We'll get details about that event toward the end of this show. But first, the seven-member task force that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake appointed last summer to consider what to do with Baltimore's four Confederate-era monuments made its recommendations yesterday. It voted for removing two of the statues, the Roger Brooke Tawney Monument in Mount Vernon and the Robert E. Lee Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson statue in the Wyman Park Dell. It also recommended keeping the Confederate Soldiers and Sailors Monument on Mount Royal Avenue and the Confederate Women's Monument on West University Parkway. Joining us now to discuss the balance of history, art, and political correctness is Alyssa Blount Moorhead, a member of Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake's Special Commission to Review Baltimore's Confederate Statues. Alyssa is also a partner at TNEG Films, an independent curator, and she's a member of the Baltimore City Public Arts Commission. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So, Alyssa, the vote to recommend removing the two monuments was close, four to three.
Well, you know, I should back up for clarification a little bit.
Please.
There has been, the process has been, and I think the mayor has been really sort of forward-thinking and sort of putting this together. And I think that because what's happened is we've had a long, careful period where we've been doing sort of a lot of research, a lot of learning, and then also a lot of public comment.
The mayor appointed the commission back in June.
Right.
So we've had
quite a bit of time and quite a bit of information. And the task force itself consists of people who have professional backgrounds in public art, in curation, in historic preservation, history. It's pretty, it's a myriad of experience. So what happened is we've gotten to the end of the sort of public comment portion, and yesterday was the first time in public or at all that the task force was able to deliberate within itself. So we were able to talk about our ideas and some potential recommendations. So I want to just start out by saying none of those things that were voted on are final. Nothing has been decided. We're not clear about what those recommendations will be, and he looks surprised.
I do look surprised. I completely understood that this is a commission appointed by the mayor, and that whatever might actually be done would be her decision. So I knew we were not, in that sense, decisions had not made. Mm-hmm. But what you just said makes me think that the commission may want to reconsider its recommendations to the mayor.
Right. Well, the recommendations haven't been made yet. So that's so. Yesterday was, a deliberation. We've been really transparent. I've been really thankful for that as well. And so all of our meetings and discussions have been in front of the public. So yesterday, in front of a gathering, we also were able to discuss what our recommendations might be and what we think about them. That's the first time we've discussed that amongst ourselves even. And so those comments, you know, that deliberation consisted of a lot of conversation about how they could potentially be dispensed with or not dispensed with or dealt with. And those conversations and recommendations will eventually be culled and discussed more, and then they will culminate in a recommendation that will go to the mayor, and they will have the final decision.
And what is the timeline for that?
The timeline is unclear. So this was the last day of those public conversations, and then we'll have more conversations over the months, which are being planned now.
This was the last day of what public conversations?
The public
comment period.
Yeah,
I see. So you had let me make sure I'm getting this process right.
Yeah,
the public comment period culminated yesterday.
Yes.
In a discussion among public discussion of
yes.
discussion in public among commissioners about
yes.
what they're thinking. As of yesterday was
right
about what should be done.
Right.
And now there will be further sessions not yet scheduled among the commission to actually gel a set of recommendations to
That's
go
right.
to the mayor.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So in that context, does it make sense for me to go back to my first question and say, what is the commission's thinking about removing statues?
We could talk a little bit about, you know, what the public heard yesterday, but I would say that a cohesive statement about what the commission's thinking is probably better represented after we have that conversation. But there were lots of ideas that were talked about. So, for example, people heard conversations about contextualizing, so keeping some and contextualizing them. And by contextualizing, they mean having other public art interventions, whether those interventions are physically public art or conversations or staged interventions around the pieces. There was conversation about the historical appropriateness of the placement of some of the pieces, and so there was a discussion around moving and what that meant, and deaccessioning, which means that it would be outside of the city collection once you deaccession. Moving them, there were, you know, it was across the range of the four options. And each one had a very specific conversation around how to dispense with it or how to deaccession it.
Well, I was not there. And so what I think I know about the public conversation yesterday is what I read in Luke Broadwater's piece in the Baltimore Sun. Mm-hmm. But it sounded, reading that, I got the impression that Larry Gibson, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, was quite full-throated in saying that he is offended by the Roger Taney statue, the statue mm-hmm. of Supreme Court Chief Justice who delivered the Dred Scott decision.
That basically
underwrote continued slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a sentiment that you perceive is shared among a majority of
commissioners? I think that's a sentiment that's shared among most people that understand what the Dred Scott case impact and meaning is. So, of course. And he was very articulate about it. He's a, you know, professor and at the law school here. So he was most vocal about that particular element. And, you know, I'm not sure if I would say he talked about being personally offended, but his comments reflected quite a bit of what we've heard also in public hearings. And they also... they are also in line with some of his recommendations about why to treat that piece separately from other pieces. But again, it's still just discussion and fodder for the later discussion.
And just to one detail about the Taney statue, is it correct that the one here in Baltimore is identical to the one in Annapolis?
It's a cast of it, yes.
It's a cast of mm-hmm. it. Because that one in Annapolis, there was controversy about that a few years ago, and the answer there was to add a statue of Thurgood Marshall in a nearby place.
Right. I think some people hold the view that it's sort of antithetical to what Taney represents, you know, and that it's in direct opposition to what he represented to have.
So it's
a Frederick Douglass
piece. It's like a debate between the statues. I want to pull into the conversation by phone Jay Barringer. He is the Maryland Division Commander of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, ma'am, Sheila. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. It's good to talk to you.
So you heard that that the commission is still discussing, and I'm curious as to what you would want to, and you have already, I understand, given comments to the commission, but at this juncture, how would you like to see the commission approach their final decisions?
Well, looking at the commission's decision, we're actually quite relieved that two of the monuments they would like to keep, but they're still getting rid of two other monuments that have both artistic and historical value. And to remove them seems very antithetical to what we are about as a society and a nation. I mean, as artwork, generally when people view artwork, they study it, they draw their own interpretation, and they look at it. And we should be studying these pieces of art and these pieces of history and learning from them, not moving them and taking away historical context.
I'm not trying to set up a debate here, but I presume, Alyssa Blunt Moorhead, that you have heard this, and I'm curious as to whether you feel there's a consensus on the commission about that point.
Yes, we've heard it. Actually, we've heard it specifically from Mr. Berenger. So I just want to back up again and correct something that he said, which is that there's a decision that's been made about removing them or not removing them. That is absolutely not the case. That has not happened. We're still in discussion about that. So that's thing one. And thing two is that I'm really concerned about people's comments in the city that are looking at things in a sort of either or proposition. And there are actually maybe four or five sort of hybrid versions of what can happen in terms of even contextualization. There's a broad range of how that might look. And there's a broad range of how deaccessioning and moving and recontextualizing and others' collections and things like that may look. So it's a very nuanced argument, and I understand for the sake of sound bites, it's a controversial issue. Really, the Confederate monuments are more about what the meaning and the cultural memory that's ascribed to them in the city, and also why they've been activated after many years, where I'm sure they've been invisible to many people in the city, speaks to something that's a wider social issue that, you know, we have to be honest about. So mm-hmm. I just want to make sure that people understand that it's very nuanced, and we've spent a tremendous amount of time in study, and we'll continue to do that and give, you know, an opportunity for all of those kinds of ideas to be aired out so that the recommendations that we make for the city are, you know, contain a sort of myriad, a real multiplicitous kind of look at what public art can do to address that ascribed meaning.
Okay, and from what I read in The Sun, one of the arguments that law professor Larry Gibson made was that when you look at Maryland's participation in the Civil War, in the war fought over slavery, many more Marylanders fought in Union forces than in the Confederate forces.
That's true.
But you wouldn't, he says, understand that looking at the public art in Baltimore, because there are more Confederate memorials than there are to the Union.
Yes.
Jay Berenger, what about that? I mean, in from your view, mm-hmm. is it a fair point to say, for this city, looking at its history, for this state, mm-hmm. looking at its history, it's unbalanced. We should remove some of the memorials just for balance.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case, because if one examines the 1860 elections in Maryland, it was a four-way race between Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, John Breckinridge, and John Bell. And Maryland was clearly not in favor of Lincoln. Lincoln only polled about 2.5% of the popular vote. So I don't, you know, to strictly look at the number of troops that went out of Maryland to the Union side and comparing them to those who volunteered for the Confederate armies, but, you know, generally the Army of Northern Virginia, I think it's more complex than saying we have too many monuments of one. And instead, wouldn't it behoove us to, rather than take away monuments, build up monuments, put new monuments to people who are worth admiration, who you know, the residents of Baltimore City can look to, or Maryland can look to, for both inspiration and their contributions to history.
Jay Barringer, I appreciate your thoughts. We're going to have to wrap this part of our show up, and so let me give Elisa Blunt Moorhead the final word on whatever part of the process you think we should be focused on as you carry it forward.
Yeah, I think that we should be focused on the nuances. So what he's talking about in terms of historical contextualization and whether or not it's out of scale with our commitment to Confederate history, I think is a little bit of a red herring. I think we need to talk about in a contemporized way and how history is accessible and contemporized. And we should learn from the interest in the Confederate monuments all over the United States and try to do something, which I think the mayor is doing, which is to look at it and do something that's innovative and radical. And then whatever we decide to do, that it makes a statement and that we activate our public spaces in a way that are accessible for people who live here now.
Innovative and radical. You've given us a lot to look forward to. I hope you'll come back and talk to us when there's a more definitive answer.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Elisa Blunt Moorhead is a member of Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake's Special Commission to Review Baltimore's Confederate Statues. Jay Barringer is the Maryland Division Commander of the Sons of the Confederate Veterans. I thank you both. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, do you know your credit score? Are you planning to pay down debt in 2016? We have some advice. Plus chocolate milk, concussions, and ethics. Sarah Gantz from the Baltimore Business Journal ties it all together. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us here for this news roundup. One of the news stories that popped up this week that caught our eye, according to data collected by creditcards.com, there is a surprising discrepancy between the income of Maryland residents and their credit scores. 2010 census data show that Maryland has the second highest household income in the nation, a little over $69,000, but the state ranks only 31st for average credit score. Maryland consumers have a credit score a few points below the average score of 669. So that discrepancy between incomes that one would think would help people manage their debt pretty well and a just so-so credit score landed Maryland at the bottom of a list of states that creditcards.com put together. When Fred Williams with Credit Card News sought a comment from Maryland government about this, he was told this by Nancy McRae, Research and Information Director at the State Department of Commerce. Quote, Maryland does have some of the highest incomes in the country, but with that comes a higher cost of living as well, depending on where in the state you are, close quote. So that's one way of looking at it. I am joined now by Nina Heck. Do you pronounce it Nina or Nina?
Nina.
Nina. I had a friend in grade school who pronounced it Nina, and I should have checked with you.
Thanks.
Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services at GuideWell Financial Solutions, which used to be known as Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Maryland and Delaware Incorporated. GuideWell is a nonprofit, fully accredited credit counseling provider that offers assistance with housing, bankruptcy, and tackling your debt. Nina Heck, based on the high median income of Maryland residents, would you expect the average credit score to be higher?
One would think so, but if you think about it, in 2008 is when we had the housing crisis, and we also suffered a lot of job loss with mergers of companies and organizations. So what I found is that when people have reached out to us, many of them are trying to recover from possibly a job where they had a much higher salary and now they're not making as much, and their credit report is a result of showing what's happened over the last several years.
I noticed that Virginia was pretty far down on the creditcard.com list also, but the factors that you mentioned would be true in a lot of states.
It would. I think it stands out a little more here because I do believe we have our unemployment rate stands pretty good, and so I think you know, in all, with the considering the population that's employed, when we lose jobs and we have losses and housing crises, it, you know, it stands out more with the with what happens.
In general, what is a good score and what is a bad score?
Well, I usually suggest to people that you want something 750 or above is a really good score. 800 is like the best.
Mm-hmm.
And then it tickles me because people will call us and they'll say, I have a 500 credit score. Is that good? So what they need to understand is you're trying to strive to get into that 700 zone or higher. But I did some analysis on just the consumers that have reached out to our organization, and I found the ones that were contacting us for help, more so with credit reports, their average score was 570.
Those are people who are turning to you.
Had contacted us for help, you know, in trying to clear up their credit report and get themselves back on track.
And what are the types of activities that cause major hits to
I said earlier, some of it had been where they had jobs where they once made much more than what they do now. So they were temporarily unemployed. And then when they became reemployed, they weren't making the income that they once had, yet they had the same expenses to try to deal with. So that, of course, impacts the credit score. Also, separation, divorce, you know, medical health issues. There's a lot of things that can impact our income and thus become what's reported on our credit report.
We're 2 weeks into the new year. So mm-hmm. for people who are still in New Year's resolution mode and have resolved to get a handle on their debt, what advice do you have? What are the top things they should keep in mind as they approach that?
We always suggest to consumers to pull their credit report, because you can get a free copy from annualcreditreport.com, and you can pull a credit report three times. And I always suggest to pull maybe Equifax, wait maybe a quarter and pull the TransUnion, and then pull the Experian later in the year. And that way you have a full coverage of a year. But you want to have that information first to make sure that everything on there is yours. And if there's something on there that isn't, that you do the proper disputing and have that information removed. But an awful lot of people this time of year will make it their goal to try to improve their credit report.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that entails having a good, you know, knowing what your income is, having a strong budget. So going through a budget with them to determine how much money is really available, if in fact they have these 500 credit scores and maybe some collection accounts or whatever on that report that's pulled it down. So you need to know how much income there is to work towards some type of a plan to repay that.
People, I'm guessing that some of our listeners were with you until you said have a budget, and they're like, oh, putting together a budget,
yes.
That's so complicated. I don't really have time to put into that. What do you tell people about putting
a budget
together?
They do say that. There's so many budgets everywhere. You know, we have one on our website, but there are
an app?
We have a budget, but there's apps as well. There's so many places that they can go, banks, credit unions, everyone's got a budget that's available to them to work. The thing that they need to start with is probably tracking their expenses, because oftentimes people generalize what their budget items are, so they don't really have a handle on them. So we always start out by asking them to kind of track their expenses over the course of 30 days and then begin to fill out a budget app or budget form to determine what they really have.
So you decide, now I really should have a budget, but
yes.
you give yourself 30 days to actually
track the expenses.
Track your expenses before you make yourself
the actual budget. Because when you talk about groceries, for example, people just come out with these blanket amounts, and then when they go to track and find out that they're in the grocery store two or three times a week, it sounds good to say it's $400 a month, but when you find out that you've had three or four trips a week that amounted to $30 or $40 in addition to your weekly grocery bill, it adds up a lot more than what a person realizes.
And what is the best way to pay down debt? Is there some clear advice you give people?
First, understanding what you have available to pay down, and then looking at your whatever the credit that you might, whether it's credit or medical bills, whatever you might have, working on something with the higher interest always makes sense. But you also want to address things that are delinquent. So, you know, it depends on where you're at and what stage of, you know, if they're current or if they're delinquent. You obviously want to address delinquency first. If they're current, you want to address things with higher interest rates and work on those, and paying more than the minimum payment. So that, I mean, everyone now sees on their credit card statements how many years it'll take them to pay off their debt. And I think that was a real eye-opener for a lot of consumers.
That this minimum payment is
take 23 years to pay the account off.
So Nina Heck, Director of Counseling and Client Services at GuideWell Financial Solutions. Last question. What tends to hold people back from starting to address
Oftentimes, it's just the fear of the unknown. It's setting up something and prioritizing where you're at. So it's easier to say that I know I need to do something, but it's another thing to actually take action and get this started. So contacting creditors oftentimes is very fearful to consumers, which is why they'll call an organization such as ours, because they're afraid. They don't know what they're going to get on the other end of the phone. Is somebody going to start calling them two or three times a day that maybe hasn't been calling? Will it increase the amount of aggressive collections on the account? Maryland's, we're wage garnishable here. So of course, if they have a really delinquent account and they, starts to surface this bill, then the fear becomes, are they going to garnish my wages? So there's a lot of things to take into consideration, but the worst thing is to bury your head in the sand and hope it goes away, because that's not what you want to do. That's why an organization like ours is there to help people if they in fact feel they need help. And keep in mind, someone comes to us sometimes just to get advice. So, we offer just advice, help them to set up that budget. We have financial coaches that will work with them to achieve goals over the course of 12 months. To get these types of things taken care of.
And we will link to your website on our website, but do you have a toll-free number that people, or a number?
We do.
And that is?
Is 800-642-2227. And we do counsel nationwide.
800-642-2227. Nina Heck, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Sheila.
Nina Heck is Director of Counseling and Client Services at GuideWell Financial Solutions. Turning now to Sarah Gantz of the Baltimore Business Journal. Thanks for coming in, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
You've been covering a recent controversy at the University of Maryland that has to do with an unpublished study on, of all things, chocolate milk, or a chocolate milk drink. Tell us the story.
Sure. So this starts with a press release that the University of Maryland put out in December, kind of around the holidays. It was a press release that talked about this preliminary study out of the university that found...
What department of the university?
It's out of the MIPS program, the Maryland Industrial Partnerships. That's a program that pairs companies, local companies, with university researchers across the university system. To help them overcome challenges or research issues that, they maybe don't have the money to do alone, but it leverages the company's dollars with university dollars to do some work that will help them address these challenges. And the whole idea is to contribute to the local economy, grow jobs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular study paired up a company called Fifth Quarter Fresh. They're a relatively young company founded in 2013 out in Hagerstown with a professor out of University of Maryland College Park. And their goal was to look at the effects of the chocolate milk that Fifth Quarter Fresh makes, whether it had any impact on helping cognitive and motor skills among high school football players. The drink is... a milk that is formulated a little bit differently than the milk you typically find in the grocery store. It's higher in protein and electrolytes and things that are intended to help players recover from, the stress of games. It's a very high-impact game. You exert a lot of energy. Drinks like this are supposed to help them, boost back up afterward.
And so, what did the study find?
Right. So this particular study looked at cognitive and motor skills. So they had all the players, half the players drink this drink after every game and practice. And at the beginning of the season and end of the season, they gave them a computerized test that is commonly used to test for the impacts of concussion. And they found that the students who had been drinking the milk had improved their cognitive abilities. They scored a little bit higher than the students who hadn't been drinking it on a few different measures that the test measures, like response rates and cognitive and motor type skill measures.
Where does the ethical concern come in?
So the ethical concerns have come out about because the university put out this press release before the study had been peer reviewed or published in a journal. Peer review is sort of the standard checks and balances of sorts for research. It's a way to validate it in some way or at least get another eyes on it. It'd be like if you or I were to, just put out a news story, write a news story and then publish it right to our websites without an editor checking it over or anyone else looking at it to, you know, fact check things. So that's partly where the question started coming. There was, you know, when I asked the university, can I see a copy of the study? I'd like to look at the details. There was no study to look at. The study hasn't been written. Ethicists and people who focus on academic research took issue with the fact that the university would be touting the findings of a study that hasn't been published yet. There is no study to look at.
So the university is investigating?
The university, after all this has come out, we've written about it. The first to flag it was this organization called Health News Review. They look at exactly this, poor news reporting or poor press releases. In other words, a number of organizations have written about this now. But after all of that, the university has said that they're going to do an institutional review. So they'll be looking at the way that the study was conducted, the university's methods for putting out the information.
Do you have a sense from anything that any of reporting so far about whether this pattern has shown up in other university research and press releases, or does this seem, from what you know, kind of a one-off event?
You know, I haven't looked too much into that yet. Okay. I will. The other instance of this that I saw was that the university put out a press release, again, related to this researcher's work with Fifth Quarter Fresh over the summer, for a different study they had done related to the effectiveness of the drink as a recovery drink, like I had mentioned, compared to some other drinks like water and, okay, you know, a whey drink. And it was a similar situation where it was a press release without a published study yet.
So you're going to be following this.
I will.
You'll keep us informed. I want to move to another story you did this week about health effects and a particular drink, sugary sodas.
Yeah. As you know, this is something that has become an issue in Baltimore. Nick Mosby introduced some legislation about it, wanting to put warning labels related to sugary beverages, warning of their sugar content. This week, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation backed a study that was published in the journal Pediatrics this week that found that parents who saw those labels, a warning label on a sugary beverage, were less likely to choose it for their child. The way the study was set up, it was an online survey, and it, you know, it was like a virtual vending machine that parents saw, and, you know, had 20 some drinks in it, 12 of them having a high sugar content. Some of the parents saw vending machines where those sugary drinks had warning labels on them. Some parents did not, saw just a vending machine the way it is today, no warning labels. And they found that among the parents who saw the labels, those were parents who were less likely to then choose that drink for their child.
So how does that finding relate to proposals in Maryland and in Baltimore?
Well, the way it relates is that it suggests that warning labels could be effective in educating people about content, about the sugar content in their drinks and the dangers of consuming a lot of sugar, and could have the effect of them buying fewer of those beverages, which is the reason why, which is the motivation behind the legislation in Baltimore.
Legislation before the city
mm-hmm,
council.
Yes.
And where does that stand, do you know?
I believe it's been introduced. As far as that, I'm sure it's something that they're going to be debating, and it'll go through the process that all of our other legislation goes through.
And you also wrote about a new space for startups in Baltimore.
Yep, it's at Power Plant Live. It's by the Cordish Companies. It's called Spark. It's a combination of co-working and desks. So co-working is... you know, say you just need one desk. You don't need a whole office. You just need one desk you're going to come and sit at and do your work. Or maybe there's three of you in your startup and you're not big enough for a whole office. Maybe you don't even need it every day. But a co-working space is sort of everyone from everywhere combined and commingled in one area. So this space is designed for companies that have sort of outgrown their space at an incubator in Baltimore. So, you know, ETC is an incubator, places like that that have limited space. And when the companies get bigger, they need to move on to their own office. At the same time, the traditional way offices and leases work here, it can be very costly. You can get locked into, you know, multi-year leases. And for companies that are so small and so early on in their development, that type of arrangement just really doesn't work. If you're a startup, you know, you might have five people now and you have no idea
when you're going to have 10,
how much money you'll have next year and what kind of business you'll be doing.
So is this Spark Space already opening?
It is open. Yeah, they had their grand opening last week. It looks beautiful. It's very cool looking. It has lots of industrial features like, you know, exposed brick walls, very big, tall ceilings, lots of fun games for everyone.
Oh, my goodness. Games, too.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for telling us about it. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Gantz is a reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. We're going to take another break here. And when we come back, what are Maryland colleges doing to make their sexual assault and consent policies more clear? We'll talk about how the movement for affirmative consent is progressing. And we'll also talk about an event this weekend to remember musician David Bowie. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Hold on a minute. I want to get myself organized here. I think I just moved exactly what I wanted to tell you about. Across the country, students and policymakers have pushed for colleges to revise their policies about consent and sexual assault on campus. A new survey by MCASA, the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault, found that progress is being made in this state. Lisa Jordan, executive director and counsel for MCASA, joins us now by phone. Lisa, tell us what MCASA found.
Well, we talked to all of the colleges across the state. There are 55 colleges and universities in Maryland, and we wanted to know how they had revised their policies about consent in sexual assault cases. And, you know, in the past, it used to be that policies would say things, basically, don't have sex without consent. And what we found is that all but four colleges have really made strides in the language that they're using. They don't always use exactly the same language, but we actually developed a chart, and we found that kind of from the most common term to the least common term, they're including things like knowing, voluntary, affirmative, clear, freely given, mutually understandable, active, informed, explicit, unambiguous, positive, and intelligent in their consent policies. So although policy is just the first step, we think that this is a real improvement.
Okay, and yeah, I see that policy is the first step, and I want to ask you about that. But this concept of affirmative consent, step backwards and tell us why you think this is so important.
Well, we look at affirmative consent from kind of a broad perspective. Affirmative consent being something that's given freely and knowingly and that's expressed in a way that's clearly understandable to both parties. And one of the reasons we're so concerned about it is because it's crystal clear that sexual assault is a huge problem on college campuses. We've now had multiple surveys showing that women in college, 1 in 5 are being sexually assaulted. For men, it's 1 in 16. And people quibble about whether it's 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 and 1 in 6. But, you know, whatever that number is, it's a huge problem. And so our view of affirmative consent is that this is important for young people to talk about, to understand, and to, you know, kind of step away from maybe some of the assumptions that they've had, you know, in high school or as younger people or just from the media.
What role do drugs and alcohol play in the sexual assault picture on campus, and how do these policies that you've reviewed and that you seem pleased with, how do they address that aspect?
Yeah, I can't say that I'm pleased with how they're addressing that part of it, and you're absolutely correct to identify drugs and alcohol and substances as an issue. On the one hand, we're finding that drugs and alcohol are involved in the majority of sexual assault cases. We want to make sure that being drunk is not a defense for a perpetrator. We're finding that victims are often unable to consent simply because they're so, you know, incapacitated. You know, on the other hand, we also see cases where kind of both parties are extremely intoxicated and the cases themselves are very gray, and we don't want alcohol to be used as a tool of rape, but we also don't want to have people who are in a situation where both are truly intoxicated, kind of intended to become intoxicated, you know, and figuring out how to make sure we're not labeling both of those people as perpetrators is a difficult thing for some colleges to deal with.
And so I want to make sure I'm straight. I get the impression reading, sort of filling in between the lines, that you think these policies, while improved in many ways, still the policy perhaps can't address that, or that these policies don't address it?
I don't think they're very well written for the large part right now, and I think that the consent part of the policies is in a much better place than the policies regarding alcohol and drugs. And I also think that although these policies are important for sure, what's even more important is the education of students, the education of the people who are responding to students, and making sure that we're really empowering survivors to make decisions.
And as we wrap up here, tell me then what MCASA is doing in that sphere, in the education of students on this issue.
Yes, we're holding regional trainings every month or every other month that are attended by students, by administrators. We're talking about things like how to have a trauma-informed response, the best practices for interviewing students, and we're also really looking at ways to ensure fairness in the hearing process to make sure that we're not jeopardizing sexual assault survivors and leaving them exposed to kind of retaliatory charges and that sort of thing. So there's really a lot to do yet, and we're happy to know that the consent policies are improved. We really appreciate the legislators in Maryland who kind of said, if you guys don't improve this policy, we're going to make you improve it. I think Frank Conaway filed the first of three bills that address that, and we appreciate his work on that. There's a long way to go, but at least we're going in the right direction.
Well, Lisa Jordan, I really appreciate your catching us up to where things stand now, and I hope we can keep in touch with you as you continue the work. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for paying attention to this issue.
Lisa Jordan is Executive Director and Counsel for the Maryland Coalition Against Sexual Assault, MCASA. You hear that, and you may recall that this past Monday, David Bowie, the iconic pop musician, died of cancer. He had just passed his 69th birthday on that day. He released a new album, Black Star. Bowie is perhaps best known in the United States for albums like Hunky Dory and Let's Dance, just a couple of the 27 studio albums he released in a career that spanned six decades. In East Baltimore, the Creative Alliance wasted no time in getting together an event for this Sunday called Be More Bowie. We Can Be Heroes. Heather Keating from the Creative Alliance is here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also Rain Alexander of Guided by Wire, one of the many bands that will be performing at the show Sunday. Welcome, Rain.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, Heather, this was a really quick turnaround. I mean, we learned of Bowie's death on Monday, and there's a full-fledged event by Sunday.
Absolutely. This came together incredibly quickly. I think we all woke up Monday morning feeling a little depressed and a little shocked, definitely, since no one even seemed to know he was sick. But we do things incredibly quickly at Creative Alliance. We were fast to realize that there was kind of an outcry for some tributes, and a lot of things came together around the city, but not with actual Baltimore bands involved. And we jumped on it really fast. I think our performance director, Josh Kahn, sent a text message around Monday night, and by that next morning, we had a show in the works. The response was amazing.
And I'm sure it's still evolving, but at
it's
this
still
moment...
still coming together. Changes every minute.
At this moment, how many bands do you expect, or how many performers do you expect to be participating?
There's a lot of performers. There's three full bands. We have Guided by Wire, of course. We have the Jennifers, their full band. And we also have Home, which is a band from New York that is actually cutting their recording time a little short to be a part of the show, which is amazing. We also have a lot of guest musicians that will be showing up. A lot of them are surprises, but a couple, Michael Lowry of Future Islands and Tony Drummond, are working together, and some people are putting together some custom groups to perform that night. They're very excited.
Ask Rain about what Guided by Wire is going to be doing. Let's play a clip from Cat People Putting Out a Fire from David Bowie's 1983 album Let's Dance. So am I right, Rain Alexander, that you're going to be doing a cover of that?
We will be, yes. We definitely will be.
How did you settle on that?
Well, it was Jack's choice. Guided by Wire is a duo with myself and Jack Pinder. We're primarily a cover band that does Guided by Voices and Nico Case cover songs. So that's something that we've always been focused on since the beginning of our band. But this opportunity came up, and David Bowie was so foundational to both my work and to Jack's work as, you know, queer-identified musicians, as trans-identified musicians. There were deep, deep points of identification for both of us. And, you know, it just seemed like a natural fit, and he was up for the challenge of putting together a set of things that, you know, maybe we've played around with before but never really gone to perform before. So we built our set list, and includes Cat People, which is Jack's choice. It's a great song.
And is there a fair amount of competition among the performers about who gets to cover what on Sunday night?
Actually, we're kind of encouraging a little bit of competition. We by no means said that only bands could play certain songs. If people get up and play the same songs, I'm sure the renditions are going to be different and equally amazing. Mm-hmm. And I love it. It's the excitement.
And I think that's the great thing about it, is this thing came together, is to watch everybody's set list build. And, you know, we're doing songs that have deep meaning for us in many ways. And I think other bands are coming from that same place. And there are a couple of overlaps, but mostly, you know, this is the great part about pulling from a catalog that's so vast. Yeah. There's so much to pick from, and there's not that much overlap yet, as far as I can
see. Yeah, true.
You're also encouraging people to come, quote, dressed in your Bowie best, close quote. So which Bowie character or era do you think will get the most representation?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we were kind of talking about that a little bit earlier, and Aladdin Sane is definitely getting the most play.
Sure.
We've been talking a little bit with Natty Bo, and they had done a Natty Bowie event not that long ago in Nashville, and so they're hopefully bringing the Natty Bo guy with the lightning bolts and everything. So that should be exciting. I think that, you know, I might be rocking an eye patch.
I'll be in pink leather. I'm not sure which era that's going to be, but
you just happen to have a pink leather.
I happen to have a pink leather ostrich skin jumpsuit. So that's coming
really
out.
Jealous right
okay.
now.
Okay, so we're out of time. When and where is this event?
The event is at Creative Alliance in Highland Town, 3134 Eastern Avenue. It's at 7 p.m. on Sunday. Please come. We want to pack the house. CreativeAlliance.org has all the details.
Okay, creativealliance.org. We'll link to that. Also, I want to thank you, Heather Keating from the Creative Alliance, and Rain Alexander of Guided by Wire, one of the bands that will be performing Sunday at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
Right. And I want to thank you all for listening, and thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guest. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great weekend. I hope you'll be back with us on Monday. We're going to have a conversation with Lester Spence, author of the new book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics. Meanwhile, a great weekend.